Thrill Me.
This show is part of the Thrill Me Podcast Network. Experience more on Facebook and YouTube.
Hey, what's going on? This is Thomas Nicholas. Welcome to the Meh Meh Total Groove with your host, Tombstone, Josh.
What's up, everybody? Welcome into a brand new episode of the Metal Groove Podcast, where I have a Christmas treat in store for all of you guys. As a drummer, this one to me is a big deal because not only is this band incredible and interesting and just a fun band to watch and listen to, they're hardcore, they're heavy metal, they are from across the pond, and they're just killer in every single way. And today on the show, I have the drummer of that band. The name of the band is Glory Hammer. The name of the drummer is Ben Turk. What is up, my friend? How you doing, sir?
Hey. Nice to be here.
How are you doing? Cool, man. I greatly appreciate you joining me on the show. A couple of friends of mine saw you guys in Charlotte, North Carolina. And they said, you have to check these guys out. And I did, and it has been an experience from the get-go. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about the band. But as a drummer, I want to talk to you about your drumming because – in particular, your double bass work is spectacular, man. But from the top, for people that aren't familiar with Glory Hammer, why don't you tell us a little bit about the band?
So Glory Hammer is a fantasy power metal band with a concept based around the city of Dundee in Scotland for reasons that are quite peculiar, I suppose, but it started out as a kind of not a parody. A lot of people think of it as a parody. It was never really not a parody. It was more of a an attempt to do power metal in the style of the way that bands used to do it in the late 90s, early 2000s, like Rhapsody and other bands like that. But just
there's a little Dragon Force sound in there too, a little bit, I hear.
Yeah, there will be. Obviously Dragon Force were big, they were like the kind of the only power metal band around in that people knew about. Obviously the Guitar Hero thing, they were I imagine a lot of people's first introduction to power metal. It's probably one of my first introductions to power metal. It wasn't something that I grew up listening to personally.
Interesting.
But yeah, essentially just trying to update and kind of repackage that classic 90s power metal thing in a way that was more, when was it, 2012, we made the first album, and I suppose just sort of with bands like Sabaton were doing really well, and the idea was just to create something that had the fantasy, all the kind of overblown fantasy trappings and the story and all of the kind of the quite silly elements, but in a way, in a streamlined, stripped down, more accessible, more digestible form that people might be able to get into more easily than some of the some power metal does have a tendency to get a bit overcomplicated, and then of course as time went on we have done some pretty complicated things as well, but while trying to keep it from going too far in that direction.
The talent kind of shines through in what you guys are doing, whether it's fantasy metal or I've seen this one thing that labeled you guys as space metal, and if you take two things I love, which is metal and space, and just interweave them, you get space metal, which is cool, but you can hear the talent behind the musicianship that's going on there, man, which is really fun. I did read another thing that said each member of the band represents a character in the story. And I think your character is called Ralathor. How did you come up with that character? Right. And tell us a little bit about that guy.
I didn't come up with the name. The name was given to me. I didn't get a say. I actually never liked that name very much. I think it sounded like somebody gave you 2 seconds to think of a fantasy name, like blah, blah, blah. But yeah. But it's yeah, and he's a hermit, which means that he's mysterious. This defining characteristic is mysteriousness, which meant that I like that because I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have a character to play. Mm-hmm. I didn't really want to have to pretend to be anything on stage. So mysterious is a very easy.
That's good.
Quality to evoke. You just don't really do anything.
That's cool. Yeah. Plus, as drummers, we're kind of in our own hut back there, anyways, kind of hidden away from the rest of everything that's going on. So it's perfect. Yeah.
I've had people complain to me, but I have a child. Well, it's a, they call it a Pang dream symbols. It's kind of like a Paiste Novo China, like it's got a Turkish bell, but it's still Chinery kind of sounding.
Yeah.
And I've had people, and I have it in the middle because it's easy to hit. It's like I have just like a row of symbols and I want to be able to access them all. And
right on.
I have had actually people complain that they can't see me because it's in front. I'm like, well, I don't, my priority is not being seen. My priority is being able to play the drums. So mysteriousness helps with that because I'm just I sometimes, and I keep adding more drums as well. I've got like 6 toms now, so
yes,
I may as well not be there. You know, you always have the classic drum like cymbal in face syndrome in photos. All drummers are familiar with this, of course.
Yeah,
but I just keep making it worse, like just more and more and more stuff until eventually. But I mean, Nicker McBrain, you can't even see anyone's there. Like, and he, nobody complains to him, as far as I know. So I don't personally think it's a big problem.
So a couple more things about Glory Hammer before we dive, because I want to hear about your kid. I want to hear about your gear. But it also says here in the character that you guys wear armor. What exactly are you putting on? And did you try to go as minimal as possible? Because it's kind of hard to drum and stuff, man.
Yeah, we change the costumes every album. We've got different, keeping to the same basic idea, but changing it based on what is happening with the story. But yeah, I always make sure that I've got something that's not too hot, and is doesn't restrict my movement too much. Sweet. And also, as I've said, you can't really see me that well, so I don't feel like I have to wear some kind of crazy elaborate thing. Just like, you know, enough details to make it interesting.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's definitely, actually, I think we had, I had this thing made. It's like a gambus, and it's like a padded sort of, it's like what people used to wear underneath chain mail, I think. That is that sort of like, it's padding and it protects you a bit, but also protects you from the stuff you're wearing. And I got one of these made, and it was so for like the music videos we did last year. Yeah.
Okay.
And it was so hot. We when we shot the music videos, it was like June, and I knew there was no way I was ever actually going to be able to wear that on stage. So I had to get something a bit more appropriate,
something a little more light. You need like 20 fans behind you or some kind of airflow going on, man.
I never seem to have a fan. I need to get on that. I should, but there's, I don't know, I forget about it. It gets forgotten about, these creature comforts.
All the things going on is normally the last thing on my mind as well. But all right, let me ask you one more question about the costume. Because I need to know about feet, man. I'm a big, whenever it comes to feet, especially playing double bass, I need room and movement. What are you wearing on your feet, man?
I just have a pair of, just like trainers or, what do you call them? Sneakers? Trainers is a UK thing, right?
I guess so.
They're just shoes that I tend to find that I wear, I just play in a pair of shoes that I'm used to wearing and that are comfortable. I've never had like specific drumming shoes.
That's good.
Although I wonder about that sometimes, but yeah, I whatever, it just has to be a pair of shoes I'm used to. Yeah. Not too, nothing too kind of, I don't want like big inflexible soles or anything like that. Something that's something that doesn't feel too, as you say, kind of restrictive.
Yeah, because when I think of like Kiss, you know, like they have Eric Singer up there in the whole Catman costume, and he's wearing like platform boots. I'm like, how are you doing? But again, he's not doing much with the bass pedal, anyways. But it's just weird.
You can afford to wear ridiculous shoes if you're playing like four on the floor.
That's a true story, man. Okay, well let's talk drums now, because that's what I'm mostly looking forward to. When did you get your start with drums, and was it your first instrument?
It was my first instrument. My first instrument was actually piano. I didn't play for very long. I think I was maybe about 8 years old, and I had piano lessons for a while, and I learned to play like a C major scale, learned the fingering for that, and I don't remember how to play anything from then. It's something I want to go back to, but then I kind of stopped for a little bit, and I took up bass guitar when I was 15, and shortly, like 2 months later, I got a guitar as well, and then about a year later, I think, was when I started playing drums. So I would have been about 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely wasn't playing power metal or anything metal. Actually, I was a kind of single pedal purist for quite a while. I got really into Led Zeppelin, and obviously John Bonham's famous for doing the one foot, all the crazy one footed stuff. And so I wanted to do that. And it was probably the first 2 years of playing, I was kind of anti double kick.
Change, man. Change is a hard thing to get over, because that's how it was too. It took me a while to transition to double bass.
I'm still doing it. I don't think I've ever quite got there.
Oh, you're so good, man. Everything is so smooth when I hear you're playing. So I think you got the hang of it.
Good enough. Adequacy. Yeah. That's what my kind of the basic goal is, just sort of adequacy. I've never had any complaints. Nobody has ever written me a letter and said,
yeah, hey, I need you to pick up that double bass, man.
So I must be doing, if not everything right, then not too much wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So do you play two bass kicks, or do you have a double pedal, and if it is a double pedal, what are you playing?
I do have two bass drums now. I didn't for a long time, but I always aspired to, and I've got the Tama DynaSync pedal.
Beautiful.
I have a double pedal and singles as well, but I really like it. It's the only direct drive pedal that I've tried which just feels like a chain drive pedal. Like I've tried lots of, you know, I've tried the Trick ones and the Axis ones and the Polish one that I can never remember how to pronounce. The DynaSync just feels like a normal pedal. I don't feel like I'm having to adjust to a direct drive pedal with it. It just feels like I could be playing a chain drive or anything else. I'm very happy with those.
Nice, man. So for anybody that doesn't know, maybe you can briefly explain the difference between playing a double pedal and then playing two kick drums. Like, which one do you think is more fluent? Which one do you think is more comfortable, and maybe the differences?
I think so. A lot of the thing with double pedal is obviously there's something different going on between both feet. Stock drive shafts are almost never any good. There's always a lot of lag. The bearings aren't as good. They tend to wear, which means that after a while you get like there's a slight lag before the pedal actually engages with the rest of the mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And so that messes up everything, you know, your balance and everything else. And it kind of depends what you're doing. You can get the retrofit. I've got a Trick retrofit drive shaft, which does make things a lot better. It's the one with the two sets of bearings.
Nice.
But I think even with the best drive shaft, you've still not got the fact that you're connecting to the. I think there's something about having the beta like on that side that you're connecting to the thing you're hitting. You're actually really playing the drum with a slave pedal. I always feel like you're playing something that's far away.
Mm-hmm. And it's its own separate entity.
You're slightly disconnected from what that foot is actually doing. Although there is one benefit I've realized is that you can look at the two beaters next to each other, and you can see if you're actually coordinate. Especially when you're playing faster stuff, mm-hmm. having the ability to like use your eyes are very important for coordination. Like it's like foot eye coordination, I suppose you'd call it. And there is something to that, but I still think the feel, you're never going to get a better feel than two single pedals. You can get close, but it's never going to be quite the same. And I just like that. It's the kind of old school way to do it. Coming from being a single kick purist, I now feel like it's the sort of, if you're going to do it, you should have another bass drum.
And it looks cooler too on stage, man, which brings me to my next. I want to hear about your setup. Do you have a specific brand that you like to follow? Like, are you a Pearl guy? Just tell me about your kit. What are you rocking?
I've got just before COVID, I ordered a custom kit from a company called Highwood Drums. They're based in Yorkshire in England. And because of the timing, it then took about 18 months before it was actually ready. But it's like, as I say, well, custom built for me. I ordered two kicks and seven toms, which I tend to use six. I'm not allowed to use the seventh one. Our sound engineer doesn't want me to have another one. I'm going to use it one day, but I actually got a seven because I couldn't decide which sizes. I couldn't decide whether I wanted 8-10 at the top or 10-12.
Yeah.
And so I got an 8 and a 14 in addition. Mm-hmm. So it's like 8, 10, 12, 13, 14, and then 16, 18 floor toms. Yeah. So I could sort of mix and match.
Mm-hmm.
More recently, I've tried both setups. Like I've been using 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18 most recently because I quite like having the higher, like having more of a range. Because I, for the first 8 or 9 years of Glory Hammer, I was playing, I had four toms. I had two rack toms and two floor toms.
Okay.
And there's something about the power metal, the difficult thing when it comes to kind of coming up with drum parts, the music is very, there's not a lot of syncopation. You're quite limited in the opportunities you have for syncopation, and a lot of the time you're playing a kick on every subdivision. You're playing either 16th or 8th notes or, mm-hmm. or whatever, so you can't do like cool stuff with bass drum placement.
So so when you say syncopation, you mean improv? Like there's not any room to improv some stuff in there?
Even if it's not improvised, you're kind of just you're playing something on every note. A lot of the time, if you're playing in a groovier style of music, if maybe you're like metalcore or something like that, you can use the spaces. You can put a kick drum in a cool place. You know, you can create interesting grooves just between the kick and the snare. But when you're playing a kick drum on every beat, every subdivision, the entire bar is completely full of them. And the same thing goes for fills. So where do you go? So the only other thing that you can really do without, also you don't want to kind of play against the music. If the music is also all like eighth notes on every bar, if the guitar is playing a riff that is like an eighth note on every bar,
mm-hmm.
you don't want to play weird accents too much because it will start to sort of suck away the groove, such as it is of the music. So the only thing left is pitch variation and a sense of sort of like melody. So that was why I always wanted to add a few higher voices in the toms.
Yeah.
Just because that's the, and also I just, there's something really satisfying about a tom fill that has lots of toms in it, I don't think.
Yes.
However many, you know, you always get like guys in their 60s on drum forums and stuff talking about the, you know, how it's, if you can play, you know, you should be able to play everything on a four-piece kit. It's like, I don't really think that's applicable for every style of music, every situation. Sometimes, like, you imagine that, what is it, Fat Bottom Girls by Queen. There's the fill going into the second chorus with two, like, starts on, like, two octobands and then goes down all of the toms. There's nothing very clever about that fill, but it sounds amazing. And you couldn't possibly replace it in the song with anything else. It's like, it's an absolute perfect fill for that moment. So I'm not going to go and tell Roger Taylor that he should have done that on with two toms.
No.
I think that would make me a fool.
You know what? It's to your interpretation. You're the writer. You're the artist. This is what you think fits. You talking about that reminded me of Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight. That's probably played on four to five toms in different. It's not even that many, and it doesn't sound that different, but it sounds perfect for what he needed it to sound like.
Actually, Phil Collins is a great example of a drummer who uses toms in a very melodic way. And again, it wouldn't improve the music of Genesis or his music if you took the toms away, because that huge tom sound is like, that's him, that's his identity. Actually, I think John Bonham as well had the whole drum kit sounded like that, but he had a very melodic tom sound with the high tunings and everything else. I think there's definitely a place for it.
Yeah, completely agreement. So is it, whenever you said you're not allowed to use one of your toms, is it on the high end or is it on the low end?
It would be on the higher end. It's mostly just to do with how many channels we have free, like the stage box, or, you know, it's like, it's another microphone, it's another channel on the stage box, it's another channel on the desk, and then you start ending up having to hire bigger and more expensive gear. So I think we're like maxed out on the number of channels. It's maybe like up to, like, I don't know, 16 channels of drum mics. And then to add another one, or maybe it's, I can't remember how many we've got on there, but it's like, I think the situation is if we added another one, we'd need to rent more expensive gear, and then maybe the desk, maybe there's like, we don't have enough preamps or something. I can't remember, but one day I'll have it, and then I'll add another three.
It's going to be glorious.
Never ending battle between drummers and audio engineers.
Yeah. Come on, man. I need more mics. Let's go. But all right. Moving on from toms. How about cymbals, my friend? What are we playing on cymbals?
I've got, so I'm a Dream cymbals artist. I have been since 2011. So before we did the first Glory Hammer record, I've used them on every album. Mm-hmm. I've used them basically every time we've done a show. And I'm a big fan of Dream for a number of reasons. One of them is, they don't have a lot of metal. It's not like the sort of typical metal drummer cymbal.
Metal drummers will
typically go for something perhaps a bit brighter a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And they have a darker, jazzier kind of character, but very, very expressive. You don't need to hit them too hard. I don't like having to hit cymbals really hard in order to get them to open up and produce a full sound. Even if I do hit them hard most of the time, it's still nice to have that control. Because there are some cymbals that are so heavy that unless you hit them as hard as you can, they don't really work properly.
They don't ring out.
You don't get that like wash. So I've got two pairs of hi-hats. I've got a 22 ride, so I've got a X hats and the regular hi-hats. I have three crash cymbals, Energy series crash cymbals, 16, 17 and 18 at the moment, and the 16 inch pang in the middle, which prevents people from seeing or taking photos of me. And then I've got a 16 inch China on the right, which is the Dream ones, they're a bit like the Wuhan ones, where it's
Oh yeah.
essentially like a Chinese, like a traditional Chinese hand symbol, and they've just drilled a hole in the handle,
Yeah.
and you stick that on a symbol stand. And then I recently added a 20-inch Pang on my left, which sometimes I forget to use, but I'm trying. I don't like having stuff there if I'm not hitting it, so I'm trying to use it more. And it sounds cool. It's like a much bigger, washier kind. It doesn't have the proper China has got a nice trashy kind of bright and quick sound, and this is a lot darker and just sound almost more like a gong. I actually do have a gong.
I was going to
I've
ask if you had a
never
gong.
used it at a show. I own one. It's in my living room
Oh, nice. Good placement.
as decoration. But yeah, I bought it when I turned 30. I'd always wanted to, again, the Bonham thing. I'd always wanted to own a gong, so I had to have one. But yeah, I'd love to be able to actually use one for the show, but it's again a space thing. When you've
I
already
gotcha.
got, like, you're already taking up quite a lot of space with the
Yeah.
rest of the drums,
Who
hauling a
else
gong
had
around
one?
is just it was
Alex
like
Van Halen had a gong too, didn't he?
everyone used to have a gong in the
Yeah.
70s and 80s. It was part of the I always think it's funny, like there was a period of time when having a massive drum kit was kind of
The cool thing.
it was essential, even if you weren't using it. Like, you watched like Dire Straits, although to be fair, Dire Straits actually do have quite a lot of Tom Fills, but you don't think of them as like the stadium rock massive drum kit
No.
kind of a band.
You're right.
But in the 80s they had all the toms and everything else, like AC/DC does half the time, but Phil Rudd doesn't even hit the toms.
No,
Like,
he
that
needs three
one
pieces.
line
That's it.
he could have got by with less,
Yeah.
but it's it was a statement. And then I guess that became very unfashionable, and everything went back to the kind of 60s style
Yeah.
tiny drum kits in the 90s.
That's cool, man. So you touched a little bit on John Bonham. Who were some of your other influences?
So, well, when I was getting really interested in that, I actually went back and I when I like what a musician does, I always like to go back and find who their influences were and listen to them.
Oh, yeah.
And so I do like that the old swing drummers like Gene Krupa. Like, now Buddy Rich is obviously amazing, but there's something about, I think Gene Krupa just has that kind of, he was the first guy who really became famous as a drummer. He was like, and he had the charisma to carry the whole band, and it's just so fun to watch him. Like, I think he's still kind of like the archetypal drummer, if you go back to at least back to those days. And then people like Bernard Purdy, obviously another big Bonham influence, but like lots of different. I mean, I try and draw from as many different things as possible. Stuart Copeland,
Oh, he's so good.
he's
His
so,
timing
yeah.
is insane.
And the way that he composes, like the parts that he plays are so interesting. Abe Cunningham from Deftones, huge fan of his. Like the bass drum placement is always so, like, he's the sort of the king of play minimalism. Just playing like he plays so, is able to play so little and just have the most gigantic impact. So I find that very inspiring. Dave Lombardo, in terms
Oh
of
my gosh.
double bass, and also I think he's such a unique player. The way that he, I think, being left-handed and playing on a right-handed setup, just that forces you
That
into doing things in a slightly different way. And the way that I love the way that he, but he also just like the energy that he puts into fills. There's a lot of like the sort of modern death metal thing of playing like four notes per drum as fast as you possibly can. I always find that very unsatisfying, but he'll be just like all over the place, and if it just sounds like, so it's so aggressive, and it's like controlled chaos, and just a great, just makes a great sound.
Yeah.
It's just there's I think there's always something. It can be hard, especially these days where everything's samples and stuff. It can be quite hard to have an identity as a drummer, as a have a sound. You know, like guitarists, they dial in their sound, they pick their gear, they get a sound, and it sounds like them. But as a drummer, you've got to do something special to have that,
to stand out. Yeah,
to have that thing where somebody can listen to it and go, "This could only be this guy." More recently, Eloy Casagrande, from who is in Sepultura, although I guess not anymore. But he's absolutely sensational, just phenomenal, like just frighteningly good. I don't understand half the stuff that he does, but I find it absolutely amazing. Lewis Cole as well. He is
okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with Lewis Cole, but he's just like an insane musician in every respect. He plays all the instruments, writes
music. Okay.
He's in a band called Noah. He does some solo stuff as well, but yeah.
Okay.
He's great. And again, I just couldn't even comprehend doing the stuff that he does.
I'm gonna have to look into it.
Yeah. Other people like Larnell Lewis, the Snarky Puppy drummers, Robert Seawright. Just a lot. Like all the kind of I would love to be able to do that, the linear fills and stuff that the cool kids do. But I have to sit and try and play bass drums faster, like the most tedious thing imaginable, sitting and playing a single stroke roll for an hour. It's not very intellectually stimulating, but
your calves must be massive, my friend.
I suppose they're okay.
Let me ask about this gong in the living room real quick. Now it's Christmas time. Are we decorating the gong for Christmas?
No, but actually last year, I did. We had a tree. A tree made out of a bunch of my toms in the hard cases. I just stacked up four or five of them, put a black sheet over it, and then put some lights around it, and that was the tree. So yeah,
I just
very useful for that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm imagining the gong in the living room is just kind of this giant wreath with some bows on it. It might look pretty sweet, man. Just throwing it out there.
I'll think about that.
All right, couple more before we wrap up here, man. Thank you again so much for doing this. You're the best. But so why is rock music from over there across the pond, as I like to say, why is rock music from over there so good in your mind, and why is it so passionate, and why does it have such a great following? Because it always seems like some of the best bands are coming from over there. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, I often think about why the UK, this is a small country, but it somehow produces really a lot of really interesting music has come out of the UK. I think it's because it's like combining, taking something from somewhere else and combining it with other things. I mean, why did rock music happen? Where did it come from in the first place? One of the big things, of course, was that you had blues musicians, rock and roll musicians in America who couldn't be played on the radio. But there were no restrictions about that here. And that was, and also because it was from America, which I guess was very exciting in like the 1950s, was a land of opportunity and promise. And so I'm sure that for young British people, that sounded like the future. It sounded like, you know, electric guitars and stuff like that. This was hugely exciting. And so they started trying to recreate these things that they were hearing. But because we're not America, and we have our own traditions and our own just cultural stuff going on, it came out in a different way it added something that was that was different, that maybe wasn't even present in the music of the musicians who inspired it.
Yeah.
I was actually having a conversation with someone earlier about the something about English music in particular. I'm not sure if I could include Welsh and Scottish in that. I don't really know if there's a if it may be the same thing, but I always think there's English music has this huge emphasis on melody as above everything else. You don't always get that, but if you listen to classical music from like English composers like Elgar and Gustav Holst and people like that, there's always this every there's always melody at the very top of it. You don't always get that in the music of Wagner, for instance. He's got tons of melodies, but he's also got a lot of kind of textural stuff going on. German music's very textural. Of course, power metal is essentially German music. It comes from Schlager. There's like the beer hall music, stuff that everyone can sing along. It's like that mixed with neoclassical music, a lot of which is going back to Bach, again, German music. There's a lot of German ideas in there. So, in that that their music tends to be text. It's a lot more about the textures and the sort of form and the shape of things, and that's sort of one of the ways. Like I'm trying to think of other examples here, but it's I think it's that. I think it's the melody. I think it's the directness of like the emotional connection that you create with melody like that. Think of the
I
Beatles.
see.
Think of the way that the Beatles, how instant. Like think of what a phenomenon that was. It seems weird looking back at how the Beatles became the biggest band in the world. These were just four very ordinary people, but they combined a bunch of things nobody had combined before. And then you could look at this like the same thing happened with Led Zeppelin, the same thing happened with Black Sabbath, which is like the sort of ground zero for heavy metal. And that was going back and combining like 60s R&B with Gustav Holst, Geezer Butler sat in the rehearsal room trying to play Mars, and then the next time they're together, Tony Iommi plays almost the same thing, but it's the riff from Black Sabbath, and it's that. It's just combining things that might not otherwise have been combined in that way. So, I mean, I suppose like nowadays, I don't even think of like rock music as being a huge. It's not the most popular thing. I think rock music is more popular in America than it is in Britain now.
Oh, geez, okay.
But like it's always funny going over there and hearing classic rock, hearing Led Zeppelin on the radio. You would never, ever hear Led Zeppelin on the radio
Oh,
in this country, ever,
wow.
unless there was like a request show, unless it was like a special request show and people were allowed to request weird things. It's just not
That's
mainstream.
strange.
It's very strange. They were the biggest band in the world, but you don't hear them. You'd never hear AC/DC on the radio in this
All the
country.
time over here.
You'd unless it's like one specific like rock station, but it's just not part of that kind of like cultural zeitgeist anymore. But it still is there. Maybe it's the same thing backwards. Maybe it's the same way that the British musicians were listening to like Little Richard and Chuck Berry and thinking it sounded very exotic and strange
There
and
you go.
different and exciting. Maybe some guy in Texas listens to a song by a guy from Birmingham or Sheffield and it's like, wow, what is this amazing thing? It's the same thing. Gloryhammer has that, I think, quality because of the fantasy thing. A lot of people don't even realize that it's a silly story about real places. They think it's all made up. It's all like Dundee doesn't exist. Dundee is a real place. It's not actually as exciting as we make out. But yeah,
That's the
fantasy.
fun in it.
People like that sense of what was that quote? Lemmy, is this? I always think of he
You got a
was
bunch of them.
quoted as saying the it was like when people don't go to a rock concert to see their next door neighbor on stage. They want to
Oh.
go and see, they go to see a being from another planet.
Yes.
And he was absolutely right about that.
Yeah, that's the truth, man. That's the truth, man. What you were saying just then, talking about some dude from Texas, Hey, a couple of kids from Michigan called Greta Van Fleet heard Led Zeppelin and they took off and ran with it. So you might be right that things have flip-flopped here between the
Yeah,
two
it's like
places.
the yeah, it's true actually, isn't it? That's the exact same thing
Yeah.
happening in reverse,
Yeah.
like 60 or 70 years later, I suppose.
That's
Not
cool,
70
man.
years after Led Zeppelin, obviously. 70 years after Chuck Berry.
All right, so all right, since it is Christmas time, I just want to know if you have any traditions or you know, what does Christmas mean to you? Briefly, sir, if you have any thoughts on Christmas.
Know if I have a lot of thoughts on Christmas, actually. Food. I think the food. I think that having foods that you don't see Christmas here is. I feel like it fulfills more the role that Thanksgiving does over there. Thanksgiving
Oh.
is the Thanksgiving is the food
Interesting.
event, isn't it? That's like
Yes.
of that time of the year. Everyone talks about the turkey. Everyone talks about all the foods, and everyone has their foods that they want to have. I'm married to an American lady, so I'm familiar with the whole the importance of Thanksgiving and how it works. And we're like for Christmas isn't obviously there's the presents and stuff like that, but not having a Thanksgiving type thing. We have turkey at Christmas, so I think that's a big part of it.
Okay. Are you guys big on decorating your houses and going to see lights?
There's lights. There's
Okay.
always lights in the in every town will have Christmas lights and at Christmas, and we'll have stuff decorated. I guess people decorate. People put up lights. I like it actually. Now that LED lights are so cheap,
Yeah.
people put them up. I always used to be disappointed when I was little. I would really like all the Christmas lights, and then when people took them down, but it was still January and grey and depressing because we don't have snow here. It was always kind of was
Yeah.
always felt sad. You didn't feel like you needed that, and now they don't take much electricity and they're cheap to buy. People have started just leaving them
Leave them
up,
up.
and I get to see them for sometimes all year round, which
Yeah, keep
is
that mood
great.
going.
As a fan of lights, I leave them up.
That's cool, man. All right, what's the best band you've ever seen live? Like you guys put on a phenomenal show yourself, but who is one of those bands that you're like, man, that was an experience?
That's a good question. I saw Snarky Puppy. Very muso choice, I know, but that was just amazing. The first time I saw them was just like just to see a band of with there were like nine of them. I know the whole band is even bigger than that, but just to see that level of musicianship and that level of just like freedom to improvise and play and everything else, and have a crowd who were all clearly musicians as well, just completely enraptured by it. That was amazing.
That's cool.
Noah, again, similar kind of thing. I've seen Noah a couple of times, and that's always just amazing. But in terms of like, I don't know, in terms of like a big show, I'm trying to think, because those are like obviously on a musical level, being dazzled by the musicianship and everything else. But I'm trying to think of a band who I've seen where it was like the show was the thing. I don't know. I saw AC/DC in 2008 at Wembley Stadium, and I couldn't
Wow.
see them.
Oh,
It was
no.
frustrating. I was actually waiting for Paul Templing, our guitarist, to, I don't know, he'd already seen them because he worked at the stadium in Cardiff, and
Sweet.
I guess he wasn't as excited as me, and so I waited for him and I lost my space, so I was like
Damn.
literally couldn't see them, and obviously in stadiums it sounds bad as well, so I felt the satisfaction of having been there, and I love
Yeah.
AC/DC, so that was still very cool. But in terms of the actual experience of the show, I don't know.
Just wasn't as fulfilling as you had hoped.
There's got, I guess it was. It was nice to think that I was there. I'm trying to think. I've seen so many bands, but nobody is standing out.
Well, maybe on a future episode, sir, we can have you come back and talk about some of the shows you've been to when they come to the forefront of your mind.
I'll have thought that by then.
But this was Ben Turk of the band Gloryhammer. They are about to embark on a double headlining tour with Beast in Black. That's going to be a killer bill, man. So make sure you guys get out there. And if you're on my side of the pond,
You guys are actually going to be coming back this way in March of next year to tour the U.S. and Canada. That's pretty exciting, my friend, man. Do you like coming over to the States to tour?
I do, yeah. It's always we're always very enthusiastically received. I think because bands, our kind of music, don't go over there very often, so people are always like they'll come from far and wide to see us, which is always very nice. Everyone's very friendly. We don't get much sleep.
Oof.
Because the roads over there, they really are not good.
They are not.
I don't know if you've ever tried to sleep while driving all the way around the United States of America.
It's well, sleeping while driving is frowned upon over here, my friend.
Well, someone else is doing the driving.
I know what you mean. I'm just messing.
But so that's not quite so keen on that aspect, but it's worth putting up with for the sake of the rest of it.
Completely understand that, man. Completely understand that. I did see that the newest release by you guys was a cover of a Cheap Trick song called. Now I'm blanking on it.
Mighty Wings.
There you go. Top Gun is what came into my head just now. But one. Mighty Wings. Yeah. How did you guys land on covering that?
I think we just really like the song. It's one of those. It's just one of those songs. I think we just felt like the kind of. We probably were listening to it and thinking we should write a song like this because this is a great song, and then.
Mm-hmm.
It ended up, we did it as it was a bonus track on the last album, and it was only on the, there was like a limited edition wooden box edition of the album, and it was on the B side of the 7-inch that you get in the box, so there would only have been 1,000 copies of it. And then that was what we originally did it for, and then we all just felt like it was a shame that nobody else got to hear it. So I personally, so I do a lot of our orchestral arrangements and stuff in our music, and like the synth and stuff like that is also
beautiful.
That's my job. So I spent ages trying to reverse engineer the synth sounds on that song because I love the sound of the synths on that.
Yeah, big time.
It's one of the things. It's just it's so unapologetically of its time.
Yeah,
it's just like it. You can't get much more 80s sounding than that song, and so I spent ages, trying to get the synths right. So
I think you nailed it. The song sounds amazing.
It was like a faithful cover, but also do some Glory Hammer. So it sounds like Glory Hammer, and it also sounds like the song.
Yeah.
So
a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, man. Okay, so where is the best place people can keep up with everything that's going on with you guys, or try and stay in touch with, or just find out where you're going to be?
That's a good question. We're always wondering about that because they keep changing all of the algorithms. You know, they change the things. You post somewhere and then one day people see it and some other day people don't. So I guess Facebook, Instagram, everywhere that you can find. It used to be so simple. You had a website and that was it. And now everyone else's websites.
Yeah, so I did see you guys are really good on Facebook. I did see something about a crowd surfing goblin lately. I was like, that looks like a lot of fun. So Facebook, website, gloryhammer.com, if you guys want to take a look at the tour schedule. But you're right, it's everywhere. It's Instagram, it's Facebook, it's the internet. You can find it anywhere pretty much. But cool, man, this was a great conversation. You gave me a lot of really good answers, man. I appreciate talking to drummers, and this was a good time, man. I hope you have a good night over there on the far, far, far across the pond.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. But this was Ben of the band Glory Hammer. Stay metal, my friend.
Cheers.
Massive shout out to Ben once again. I appreciate him so much for joining me on the program this week, not only to talk drums, but to spread the word about his amazing band Glory Hammer. If you are not familiar with them, do yourself a favor and check them out. Listen to all their albums. Buy some merch. Support those guys as much as you can. And if you see they're coming to a town near you, please go check them out. Great band, great music, great show. And once again, man, glad he was on the show. Also, massive shout out to everybody that listens. Appreciate you guys so much. And if this is your first time checking out the show, please make sure you hit that like and subscribe button. join us here at the Thrill Me Podcast Network for all of the fun things that we have going on, especially here on the Metal Groove Podcast. Appreciate y'all so much, and until next week, stay metal.
Hey, that's the show for this week. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Please make sure you hit that like and subscribe button. And join us here at the Thrill Me Podcast Network, where you can check out phenomenal shows like Haunters Podcast, The Review at Rob Show, The Mr. Wonderful Show, and Core Memory Unlocked. We greatly appreciate you, and until next time, stay metal.